Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to our 14th annual Writers Symposium by the Sea at Point Loma Nazarene University. I'm Dean Nelson on the journalism faculty at the university, and today we have the privilege of having Dr. Pauline Chen with us. Her book, Final Exam, A Surgeon's Reflections on Mortality, was a New York Times bestseller. She was trained in medicine at Harvard, Northwestern, Yale, the National Cancer Institute, and UCLA, where she was voted Physician of the Year. She lives in the Boston area now, works as a liver transplant surgeon, and writes the Doctor and Patient column for the NewYorkTimes.com. Dr. Chen, welcome to our symposium.
Thank you, Dean.
When you first started writing about your experiences and your observations as a surgeon, things you thought about in dealing with patients, did you do that with an audience in mind, or were you just doing that just for the sake of the act of writing?
That's a very good question.
Well, they get better. We go up from here, Paul.
Okay, the warm-up. You know, it's interesting. When I first started writing, it sort of just happened. It's interesting. I've always been drawn to writing. I remember very clearly being about 6 years old and wanting desperately to learn how to write words so that I could put stories down on paper. And I wrote in high school. I was on the school newspaper. And enjoyed writing papers in college. Always knew that I would probably do better in those classes that required papers than classes that required tests, which is why it's sort of amazing that I'm in medicine.
It is.
But then when I was in medical school and throughout residency, I really I didn't write very much at all, other than medical stuff. I was just too busy. If I had any time at all, I chose to sleep or eat. But I remember that as soon as my training was finished, almost to the day, probably, so as soon as I had a little more time, I found myself drawn again to writing. And I began writing these short stories, fiction. And I think I wrote for myself, or just to write, for the act of writing.
So you weren't thinking about connecting with an audience. You were just thinking about getting this out.
Yeah, it was almost obsessive. I remember that I would stop by the nurse's station and I'd get blank pieces of progress note paper and I'd start writing stories. Or I would go on procurements for organs, because that was part of my job, and I would, we'd be flying in helicopters to these hospitals, and I would sit there in the middle of the night, and these ideas would come up, and then I'd get to the hospital, I'd run to the locker room so that no one would see me, because it was a little obsessive, and I would start jotting down ideas. So I think it wasn't really for anybody, it was because it had to come out.
Why do you think that was so important? I mean, you've been surrounded, your whole professional life, you've been surrounded by grief and death and awful, awful things, and that has driven this desire then to say something. What do you think that's about?
I think it goes back to... to our being human, actually. Mm-hmm. I really believe that stories are primal, and the idea of putting your experience in some kind of narrative form is really something that we're driven to do instinctively. I have six-year-old twin girls, and it's been really interesting to watch them grow up because they do that, and they'll come and they'll tell me about their day, and it's always in a story form. And granted,
it's not just information. They're putting it in a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Right, there's a narrative arc. And, it may be because they live with two parents that happen to be really into verbal stuff. But I think this is something that's sort of very, very human. And so I think I was sort of trying to put my experiences into that, because things happen so fast in medicine. They happen so quickly in training that, you know, the cliche, you're drinking from a fire hose, it really is that experience. And so when I had a moment of time, it was like I needed to put some kind of order on it. But the interesting thing to me was that I couldn't do it truthfully, that I had to do it in a fictionalized account.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, they were all short stories. There was no I in it. There were no patients that I had really taken care of. But there were elements of everything together. I remember I wrote this one short story about a baby that had died in the ICU, and I had taken care of a lot of children who were waiting for liver transplants, and a lot of them had died. And I wrote about the mother, and it was all made up. I wrote about the mother seeing her baby die and holding that baby until the sun rose, and that the baby becoming cold and her weeping. And when I wrote the story, I thought that this was sort of fiction. But in fact, I had seen that kind of thing happen. And what I needed was, and I suppose every writer needs this in some way, was I needed support. And I ended up taking a couple of writing classes at UCLA's writers program. And in the middle of my second course, both teachers were amazing, but in the middle of my second course, the teacher said, "Pauline, I need to talk to you." And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to flunk this course, because I had missed so many classes because I was transplanting all the time. And
oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. That's a great excuse.
I know. Well,
my students use that all the time. Yeah, you got to be a little more creative than, "I'm doing a liver transplant." Oh, yeah. Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, that's okay. But she... But she said, she called me and we talked, and she said, "You know, Pauline, you have to write these stories." And I think I took that as a form of permission to write what I really wanted to write about. And so I started writing the truth. I started writing about what had happened, what I really wanted to write about.
There's a really interesting passage in Final Exam, where you finish telling the story of your 83rd procurement. Yeah. And the person that you are removing a liver from reminds you of yourself in many ways. And you tell this very, very gripping story, but it wasn't that story that really reached me. What reached me was the very next sentence after that, which said, "Soon after that, I began to write." So I want to know, what was it about that incident where you faced what looked like your own mortality there that drove you to telling these stories? I assume those two things were related.
Yes, they were. Although I've never really thought how they were related. I mean, when I wrote that second sentence, that last sentence, it was because that was the way the timing worked. I suppose, this woman, the 83rd procurement, was an Asian American woman who looked like me on the table. And by then, most operations, there's a rhythm to it. It's like learning to drive a car. You learn the basics and you sort of feel comfortable with the steps, although every person is slightly different and challenging in their own way. And so I went into that operation fully sort of expecting to do the operation and to bring this precious gift to somebody who was waiting in our ICU. And when I walked in there and saw this woman lying on the table that looked vaguely like me, it was a little disconcerting, but I sort of closed up quickly and sort of did my job, and we draped her in the sterile drapes, which basically you cover the patient completely, and all that you see is sort of an opening from here all the way down to the pubic bone. And I began the operation. And I was to take care of the chest area, and the other surgeon, was going to take care of the belly area. So I began to cut down the middle of the chest, and I must have done a lousy job draping because the drape that covered her breast slipped. And I looked down, and it was as if I had stepped out of the shower and was looking into the mirror, because her breast looked like mine. And I remember stopping and just sort of stepping back. And you have to know that the instruments that we use to do this operation, it's an electrocautery instrument, and it helps with bleeding. And so, and it's an instrument that's used in almost every operation, but what you smell is burning flesh. And so I saw this, and I smelled this, and it was really difficult. And so I stepped aside and covered her up again and kept going, but the drape kept falling. And so I left that operation feeling as if my world had sort of, it was looking at myself and thinking about my own mortality. And I had never had to do that so directly before. But I didn't really understand it. You know, I didn't think about, oh, this is my own mortality. I'm looking at myself. All I did was feel it. And I felt it intense. I smelled it. You know, it was just all my senses were involved. And I suppose I began to write because it was such a powerful moment that I had to understand it in some way. And what was fascinating for me in writing that section of the book, that narrative, was that I wrote it because it was a recurring thought. I kept thinking about this woman. She kept coming back to mind. And so I felt like I had to write about it. But it wasn't until after I wrote about it that I understood it. And so I think that's
this goes
why.
Back to your point that stories are primal. This is how we understand the world. This is how we understand ourselves. This is how we understand our mortality. It is through story. And I think you proved it, and that's what caught me so much by that very next sentence, that you go right into writing from this facing your own mortality.
Facing my end, yeah. I hadn't really. Thank you, Dean.
Oh, yeah.
You don't.
No extra charge. When I'm also remembering, after you took some of these writing classes, you said that you reread some of your stories afterwards, and you were disturbed by what you had become. What does that mean?
Oh. You know, I think it's really important as a writer to be really honest. First of all, I think your readers are smart. They know when you're not being honest. But I think that's really, really important. And so in writing these stories, I was as honest as I could be about myself. And that meant being pretty honest about how I had taken care of patients, how I had changed over time. You know, I went into medicine like almost everybody who goes into medicine is. I wanted to help people, and I really wanted to do that. But in that amazing training process, I changed as much as anybody changes in ways that that were pretty awful. And the writing allowed me to see that and to face that in myself. It was hard. You know, my husband, when I write, you know, sometimes I'll talk to him and I'll say, this is really so hard. Or, you know, and this is, I mean, I cry in front of the computer a lot. I go through this really emotional sort of thing. And so I'll tell him, this is really hard. And he said, you know, Pauline, if it's really hard, it's got to be good.
So if you were just sitting there just banging it right out, yeah, then maybe not so good.
Yeah.
Is there a correlation there?
Yeah. Yes.
So now that you're doing this on a regular basis, you have a weekly column for the NewYorkTimes.com. You're working on other stuff. How do you keep notes? Richard Seltzer, the great doctor writer, what he used to say was he kept 3x5 cards in his lab coat. And so after he'd visit a patient, he'd go out into the hallway and just jot down some notes, come back into the office on Saturday, spread those 3x5 cards out on his desk and say, who wants to be a story today? How do you work? That's not a bad method, by the way.
I know. I'm trying to keep notes. I'm not so organized. You know, for a while I tried to be more organized in that way. Like I carried around a notebook and tried to take notes, but then I'd lose the notebooks or misplace them, or my kids would get a hold of them and start drawing pictures and tearing out pages. And so I'm not that good. I do, you know, occasionally I'll put notes into my computer, but really how I find the stories is I sort of think about what comes to mind and what people do I keep thinking about? Because I think one of the questions that I try to answer when I'm writing is, why do I keep thinking about them? There's some reason that their story keeps coming to mind. And often it has to do, I mean, it's sort of like dreams, I think. It has to do with your subconscious, with things that you're working out, things that you somehow feel don't quite match in the greater world. And so I think that is usually how I do it. I figure out what comes to mind and why I keep thinking about it. And that, I think, is the hardest part, ultimately, about the writing is, you know, you can write the story and you can write about what happened, and it's pretty easy to remember things if these people, people really make an impact on you. I mean, it's amazing. You talk to physicians and they will remember with incredible detail things that had happened 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I mean, they're patients that keep coming back to mind. So it's easy to get all of that stuff down, but what's hard is to figure out why you keep thinking about it, why you can't forget it.
You're just such an interesting mix between this mysterious world and this very scientific world. And here's a great sentence of yours. Stories or narratives seem antithetical to today's emphasis on evidence-based clinical practice. Stories offer no statistical power, no data to repeat and confirm, but what narratives have over all other forms of research is the ability to get to the heart of the experience. That's what you're talking about.
Yes.
Okay, here's my other favorite Pauline Chen line. And I'm wondering, did this just flow out of you, or did you have to work at this? This is your description of a perfect liver. This is awesome. You're going to love this. A perfect liver on ice has a nearly radiant sheen, a wet brown anterior so flawless that it reflects light. The broad, curved surfaces meet in sharp juxtaposition at the periphery, creating fine edges that would slice your fingertips if they were made of steel, not hepatocytes. That could be a sonnet. That's just an awesome... I'm serious. That's an awesome sentence. Now, did you work at that, or did you just see a liver and say, this is what a liver looks like?
You know, Dean, part of my business is knowing what's a good liver and what's a bad liver. Because sure. when you yeah. get a liver for a patient, you need to know. And so you learn how to identify livers that will work well and livers that won't. And that, you know, and what amazes me is that livers that won't work are ugly. You know, they're ugly.
Really? It's you can tell. You can look at a liver and say,
you would look at, no, you don't have to be a liver person to know. You would look at it and you'd say, that's ugly. And then, but beautiful ones, I mean, ones that work beautiful. So I think, you know, it sort of came from the subject. Perfect ones are the most, okay, now I'm
it's fine. I tell our students, you write what you know. This is what you're talking about.
I mean,
about.
It is really, they are really gorgeous. They're totally, they're shiny, they're soft. You feel them, and they feel like perfection. They feel like that.
No, this is awesome. This is awesome. These are sounds of awe.
Yeah, and then ones that are bad, like a cirrhotic liver. I mean, they're scarring. They're scarring. They're hard. They're shrunken. They're terrible. And fatty livers are just. Yeah.
They offend you, it sounds like.
Yes, but they would offend your aesthetic sensibilities as well.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, what's next for you? I mean, do you see yourself doing more of this kind of writing, describing organs? I mean, you've got two kids. You're a world-renowned liver transplant specialist. You write books. You write a column. What's ahead for you?
You know, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, I would have said, I would have told you. I think part of medical training and is, you know, you sort of think in 5-year chunks, 10-year chunks, okay, I'll get through medical school, 4 years, I'll get through residency, you know, X number of years, I'll get through this. But the last few years of my life have just, I would have never sort of, it's not something I planned. But I love what I'm doing. And I guess I could tell you that I can't imagine not writing, which is why I wonder how I ever got through residency, which is maybe the reason why I was grumpy sometimes in residency. But, you know, I can't imagine a life without writing. But I wouldn't have been able to predict that I would be writing so much now 5 years ago. So I don't know.
Why do you think you've resonated so well with audiences, non-medical audiences, as well as medical audiences? What do you think about that you've been doing and writing about that has connected so deeply?
Thank you.
It's a true statement.
Yeah, I think it goes back to being truthful when you write and being honest. Because I think a lot of experiences are shared human experiences. I'm scared of dying. I'm scared of death. Death is really hard for me. When I take care of people that are at the end of life, I have to make myself do what I know is right. Because it's hard. And so I suspect that a lot of other people feel that way. And I think it's I guess because I was honest. I don't know, really.
Well, I think you hang language on something that we're afraid to talk about. Don't you think that's part of it?
Yeah, I suppose so.
We have, just in our closing moments here, we have a lot of people who will be watching this, a lot of people in this audience who are medical students, wannabe medical students, nursing students. What advice do you have for them?
I think medicine is an incredible profession. And medicine meaning any kind of healthcare provider. It's really, I still feel very passionately about it. It's a job where you can go to work and you can touch people and you can really, truly leave the world a better place. And how many jobs can you, where are there where you can do that? But I guess my advice would be to remember what drove you to do that work in the first place. That there are a lot of really difficult things now with the healthcare system, with practicing in all fields of medicine. And I think it's very easy to become disillusioned. And it's very easy to take that out on the very people who come to you for care. But I think it's really important to remember that what we do is such a privilege. People come to us really essentially with their hearts open, with totally trusting you as the doctor. And for you, it may be the 100th patient that you've seen that week. But for that person, it's the first time that they've gone through this. And I think it's important to remember that, to be able to put yourself in the other person's place. I think it's also important to remember to take care of yourself, because you cannot care for somebody well unless you've taken care of yourself. And I think that healthcare professionals do experience things like compassion fatigue, like moral distress, and I think we really need to take care of ourselves. And I think the other piece of advice I would have, and I think this is for doctors and patients, is that, you know, we all essentially want the same thing, which is the very best care for those we love. And I think what's important to remember is that we do want the same things and to come together in that desire. I think one thing that has saddened me about healthcare is that I think we're sort of diverging. And it's sort of a tragedy because we really do want the same things. We could be much more powerful together.
Dr. Pauline Chen, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.